We want to remind you about a podcast that we really enjoy and think you will too. It's called A Bintel Brief, and the co-hosts were our guests on episode 297. Back for its second season, The Forward has turned one of the most historic advice columns into a fun, modern, conversational show. Each week, two very different Jewish mothers, Gina Green, a writer and movement builder from the South, and Lynn Harris, a comedian, come together with The Forward's archivist, Chana Pollack, to dish on the dilemmas of Jewish American life, identity, culture, and politics. Both historic and conversational, we really think you'll like A Bintel Brief as well. You can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 326. Whose canon is it anyway? Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And today we are going to be talking about Jewish storytelling. Our guest today is Marcus Holley. Marcus Holley is a Philadelphia-based theater artist, ritual leader, and operatically trained vocalist who is also a magid, which is an office of traditional Jewish leadership that many people don't know about, and which, like some other offices, is being reimagined and revivified in our own time. We've been talking for a while about our newest project, the UnYeshiva, which we call a digitally driven center for Jewish learning and unlearning. Marcus Holley is going to be teaching one of our short UnYeshiva classes, and it's starting in just over a week. So we wanted to have them on the podcast to talk about the class and to talk about the whole idea of Jewish storytelling and why we think it's so central to what we're trying to have as part of the learning and thinking about Judaism as part of the UnYeshiva. The UnYeshiva features classes taught by some of our favorite and listeners' favorite podcast guests, so you can spend more time with them, get to know them personally, learn from one another, and build an unbound Jewish community, a growing unbound Jewish community. But sometimes there's someone that we know would be great to teach in the UnYeshiva, but we haven't had a chance to have him on the podcast yet, so we're going to correct that today. Marcus Holley is our guest on this week's episode of Judaism Unbound, and they're going to be starting to teach in just over a week. Marcus Holley's UnYeshiva class, like the title of this episode, is called Whose Canon Is It Anyway? An Exploration of Jewish Storytelling, is 3 weeks of deep unraveling and rebuilding the canon of tales that have defined our understanding of what it is to be Jewish for millennia. So if you love this conversation as we do, you can just go ahead and sign up for the full class at judaismunbound.com/classes. And our two other UnYeshiva classes, one with Abby Stein on gender and Jewish mysticism, and one with Sean Leisha on Karaite Judaism, start in just a few days, even before Marcus Holley's class. So if you want to sign up for those, you might want to head over to our website right now, take a break from this podcast, go sign up for those classes, and then come back to listen to this wonderful conversation. So a few more words of introduction for our guest today. As Marcus Holley tells the story, he began his professional singing career about a decade and a half ago, and after a particularly meaningful Passover Seder, began exploring their identities as a queer, Black, and Jewish person artistically. This exploration led to the creation of Nigunim and original music, new interpretations of Torah and liturgy, and an original theater piece called Go Down Moshe. Marcus Holley's work has been developed, recognized, and presented by organizations including the 14th Street Y, the Union for Reform Judaism, and the New York Jewish Week. As a ritual leader, Marcus Holley has facilitated spiritual experiences for communities across North America, including Chavurat Shir Chadash, Jews in All Hues, and Lab Shul. Marcus Holley received ordination as a Magid under the tutelage of Devorah Zaslow, who is a Magidah, and David Zaslow, who is a rabbi. We are so excited to welcome them to the podcast and to the UnYeshiva faculty. So Marcus Holley, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thanks, Dan. It's really good to be here with y'all.
Well, we were interested in starting and talking about the office of the Magid or the storyteller. There are a lot of offices that we talk about on this show. Well, specifically the office of the rabbi that we talk about as potentially needing a reimagination or perhaps needing something to come into place of that office. I'm wondering about the office of the Magid. Can you tell us a little bit about what that has been in the past and what it means to be that today?
Yeah, absolutely. So historically, as I've always understood it, the Magid was mostly like a 17th and 18th century sort of figure where you'd have your rabbi who was very preoccupied with like the legal bits, and you'd have these Magidim tellers who were sort of responsible, for lack of a better word, for sort of the spiritual health of a community. So you'd have your magid who would deliver a Devar Torah, a sermon on Shabbat morning, or who might tell a story to sort of help people understand what's happening in the Torah that particular week. And one of the interesting features, I think, of sort of the magid historically was that the idea is that we would travel. If you like Google magid, I think in either the dictionary or Wikipedia, one of those kind of websites, magidim are described as itinerant preachers, going from place to place to place to place to preach some sort of word to the people there who need it. And that's sort of how it started. And there's been this resurgence of this idea of sacred storytelling in the last few decades. There's been, people are starting to pour sort of resources into this idea that, okay, we have rabbis and we have cantors, but maybe we need other stuff. Maybe there are other gaps that need to be bridged. Maybe there are roles in communal life that need to be filled that are not these two dominant ideas. So we enter the magid. So my background is very in theater. I went to school to study opera. I did that professionally for 12, 13-ish years. I still do it from time to time. So I'm very involved in, I've always been very involved in performance and sort of what we can learn from that. And so when I'd first heard about the magid as an idea, I was like, oh, okay, a sacred storyteller, a storyteller with like a purpose. What's that all about? What I have loved about it is that the magidim that I have trained with and studied with and learned from all kind of approach it a little differently. And it gives us this opportunity to tell stories, reveal Torah that are very personal to us. For example, in the program that I was in, we were writing, you know, Divrei Torah, we're writing sermons for the various Torah portions, the Parshiot. I don't remember the name of the Parsha offhand, but it's this introduction of Jacob and Esau, right? I was reading into the Parsha and they described Jacob as sort of an Ish Tam, this sort of like mild man, this mild person. And I was really struck by that. I was like, for me as a queer person who's been out for a very long time, I started thinking about, you know, what are the ways in which some of queer life has been depicted historically and how it's depicted now? And some of that is this sort of this mild, generic, kind of bland, milk with toast sort of idea. And I started to look at Jacob as this, okay, maybe this is a biblical queer ancestor. And I sort of really like linked onto that. And then him leaving home, wrestling with the angel, the whole thing, it became for me this entire allegory of sort of self-actualization. Being a magid now, not only is that kind of exploration welcomed, but it's almost expected.
You mentioned that you studied to be a magid. I mean, like, how does one get into this line of work? And how did you initially, you said you heard about it, like, how did that happen that originally you came across the concept? But then, like, how does one become a magid as opposed to, you know, my uncle who's just good at telling stories?
I always kind of describe the magidic education landscape, which talk about a mouthful, as kind of the Wild West, because we don't really have the institutions and the bureaucracy that we do when it comes to like, okay, you want to be a rabbi, this is how you go become a rabbi. You want to be a cantor, this is how you go become a cantor. I first heard about the magid, I think it was 2017. I was at Svara's Queer Talmud Camp. It was my first time. And I met a magid there, Joey Netzwerk. And he and I got to talking about what it is that means and what he does. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And then I met Joe Singer, who's also a magid. There was something just really exciting and really urgent, really sticky about that idea for me. So I was like, okay, cool. I wasn't quite committed to sort of figuring out how to become one just yet. I was like, okay, that will come later. My later actually started in 2019. The program that my friend Joey did, they were doing their first kind of online remote cohort. So that program was led by Rabbi David Zaslow and Magida Deborah Zaslow. And Magida is a female magid. Every Sunday for 2 years, we would meet for 2 hours and we kind of traded off each week. So 1 week was the Siddur sort of prayer book exploration and sort of finding ways into some of those prayers that hadn't been explored. And then the other weeks would sort of be kind of the storytelling weeks, learning stories, practicing stories with each other. There was some also sort of original authorship of stories that we were doing as well. So it really became this program of not just how do you tell a story, but how do you find the story that needs to be told? And also how does that intersect? How does that overlap with Torah?
My first experience of hearing the phrase Magid. Well, first off, there are those historical figures that are called Magid. And I had heard like the Magid of Mezrich, who was one of the early Hasidic teachers. That's like what he went by. And he was one of the first students of the Baal Shem Tov, of like the founder of Hasidism. And for that reason and other reasons, you've alluded to this, but like Magid, I think it's fair to say it's like a role associated specifically with like Hasidic tradition. I'm interested if your vision for it is that it would be beyond that, by the way, but that's not exactly what my question is now. What I first heard about Magid was I was in a class through Aleph, through this rabbinical seminary I was in, and one of my teachers, I'm gonna say his name, Victor Gross, he was talking about his son. And so Reb Zalman, the founder of Jewish Renewal, actually like worked with him, and he taught him a bunch of Hasidic stories. And he like gave him a whole like Rolodex of stories that he needed to know. And then he said, okay, get to know these stories really well. We're going to meet soon. And I'm going to ask you to tell me 10 of these stories from this list. And if you do, like, I'll ordain you as a Magid. And so he preps. And of course, Reb Zalman specifically asked him 10 stories that were not on that list, but they had talked about. And, you know, he passes. And that story is interesting to me mostly because Reb Zalman's assumption was that there was a certain specific set of stories that one needed to know in order to be a Magid. I don't know that that's fully his assumption, but at least as a starting point, he was like, there are these Hasidic stories, and to be a Magid is to be familiar with those stories. Would he say never tell other stories? My guess is he would not say that. But still, it was kind of this notion of there are the stories already. And then you transmit them with some creativity, with some flair, but you transmit them. And the sense I get is that's not exactly what you're saying. You don't seem to be suggesting that there are like some finite number of stories that Magids know, in the way that there are a finite number of Torah portions, or in the way that there are a finite number of pages of the Talmud. But I'm curious to hear from you, like, is it that one familiarizes with an existing set of Jewish stories, especially Hasidic ones, and then tells them creatively? Or is it about the art of storytelling beyond that?
For me, it's sort of yes and. I don't know if I would say a hard requirement necessarily, but I do think that there is value in sort of familiarizing oneself with, okay, like this is the landscape of stories that we have, whether those are Hasidic stories or sort of stories in the Talmud, or even sort of taking stories out of the Torah and sort of like polishing them and finessing them in a different way. I think there's definitely value in that, and that's definitely part of it. And on the flip side of that, there's this idea of, let's say this Hasidic story has been around for a few generations now. What is there to learn from it? And how do we want to approach that story in a way that perhaps the people of 2022, is that the year we're in, can sort of glean something from it? And so an example I have of that is sort of a program that I worked on before starting the Magid program. So when I was still living in New York, I was a fellow at the 14th Street Y, and they have a fellowship called LABA, which is a laboratory for Jewish arts and culture. And the idea is that they have 10 to 12 fellows each year who commit to monthly text studies and then producing a piece of work around the theme of the year. So the year that I did it, our theme was life and death. And a story that has been sort of sitting in my bones as a queer Black Jewish person living in the United States is, what are other ways to understand Passover and the Exodus narrative, holding those identities in one place? For my sort of showcase, I put together an excerpt of a show that I've been calling Go Down Moshe. It takes the narrative of deliverance that we're very familiar with, but reinterprets it, reimagines it using Negro spirituals, the narratives of formerly enslaved people, as well as civil rights era music, because what does deliverance mean to someone like me living now with these legacies in my body? And when I was actually interviewing for my program, the Magid program that I did, when they Googled me, they actually found this show. And they're like, can you tell us a little bit about that? And I told them about it. And they're like, yeah, this is the kind of stuff a Magid does. So yes, what's out here now? What can we be familiar with? And what's missing, either from that canon of stories itself, like what needs to be created, or what's missing in the perspectives to make them relevant and vital and important to folks in our current time?
One of the things that struck me over the years is this kind of thought experiment that what if it turns out that human beings learn best, but I would almost say only from storytelling, that there's something about who we are that we're actually hardwired to learn through storytelling and more or less through nothing else. That, yeah, you can learn certain things from a textbook and facts and figures, but it's hard to hold that in memory and it's hard to really manipulate that. And unless you're like a very unique person, and there are some, in a way I'm saying like I worry that our Jewish world is set up to mostly have people who do not teach through storytelling or who are not trained in it or very good at it. And they're the ones that are in charge of the spaces where people show up. And so people walk away not really grasping much, not being able to hold on to what they've been given. And yet there are people like you going around Magids who might actually be able to teach, but there aren't the context for which people encounter them. So I'm wondering if I'm wrong about that, if there are already places where you do your Magiding work, or what might you imagine being a future in which Magids played a more important role in Jewish life?
Yeah, wow. That is an incredible question, Dan. So hearing you ask, it sort of reminds me of a quote from, I believe it is Beverly Sills, who was sort of an operatic soprano. And one of the things that she is known for saying is, art is the signature of civilizations. And when I first heard that, I was sort of knee deep in the beginning of my opera career. And I was like, ah, yes, I am doing this noble, virtuous thing by singing these old operas and sort of bringing them to life. I've sort of, I think, internalized that saying in sort of my work as a Magid. So for example, like I've spoken with colleagues of mine, sort of rabbis and cantors, about sort of the kind of stuff that I do. And the reaction that I get is, oh, wow, like we don't really learn that, or we don't really learn sort of the way that you've been taught and are trained to teach. Can you teach us? And it's like, okay, well, that's interesting. And so a question that I've been asking myself a lot recently is, what is my role as a Magid in sort of the spreading of sort of the Magidic craft, whether that is creating or ordaining new Magids, whether that is helping sort of existing clergy people dig into what is sacred storytelling and how do we do that, or whether that's, you know, just putting my own work out there into the world through social media or writing or what have you. And so I think it's an open question. There are, you know, there are relationships that I've had with certain organizations where they'll say, hey, will you come and teach for us? Will you come and tell a story during, you know, a special Shabbat service? Or will you give the drash or the sermon that day? So there are these kind of like, I think, smaller inroads being made into sort of institutional Judaism. But I think one of the strengths of sort of this resurgence of the Magid as a role is we're all sort of figuring out what it looks like together. There's no, you know, CCAR, there's no Central Conference of American Rabbis for Magids. So we don't have sort of a central body where we're trying to, you know, have bylaws and decisions being made. We're all sort of figuring it out kind of piecemeal on our own. There's not yet a central way that we're doing it.
There are at least two stories that I feel like are quite central to the experience of American Jews today, or not today, but in the last half century, and they are Fiddler on the Roof and Schindler's List. Those stories are so deeply ingrained into so many people, but they also don't really seem to fully be the stories that we need right now in our American Jewish world. And I'm kind of wondering, like, what we do about that. How do we find the next Fiddler on the Roof that really becomes the story that can define a century? And that's a little different from your itinerant Magid who's got a bunch of little stories, you know, but maybe the two go together. So maybe my broader question is, how do you think about the function of story in the emergence of what it means to be Jewish in our time?
It's interesting thinking about this question sort of through my lens of sort of theater and opera, sort of just like how I've been trained. One of the ongoing questions, especially in opera spaces, which is where I'm in most often, is, okay, you know, we've done this opera by Puccini, La Boheme, like 5 million times. The Bohemians are tired. Can we let them go? Right? Like what stories are we missing by continuing to sort of hold up these older ones that we know people like. And I'm not quite sure actually how this necessarily would transition into sort of film or a larger medium, but some of that is broadening who gets to tell the stories. There's a lot of gatekeeping that happens in the art. And so I think that becomes the first big question of sort of the role of story and sort of American Jewish life is who are we allowing to be in the room when these stories are being created, whether that's, you know, small scale Magid stuff or big picture movies, theater, opera, things of that nature. And I think that's really where it starts is who are we letting into the room and who are we letting into the room with the creative control that their voice has.
Two scattered thoughts quick. First off, I am fascinated by the fact that not too long ago was Passover, as we record this, which has a section of the traditional Seder that's called Magid. That might be a lot of people's first association with that word. And also, by the way, for people familiar with Hebrew, Magid is tied to the word Haggadah, like the name of the guidebook or storytelling, the physical storyteller of Passover. And I'm fascinated that we haven't mentioned that yet. And I don't think that's wrong. I think that Magid has a separate set of associations related to this role in Hasidic tradition and what it is as a person today. But it also is like that part of the Seder where we tell the Passover story. When Dan started that question about Fiddler on the Roof and Schindler's List, I actually thought you might be saying that one of the core stories for American Jews is like the Exodus story. So that's a scattered thought. The other scattered thought, you mentioned that rabbis, when you tell them that you're a Magid and that you've been trained to learn how to tell deep stories and how to engage a room and how to look for stories, they say, you know, teach me how to do that. And that's an interesting response. So I went to like the Jewish Studies Conference and people are like, oh, I study medieval Jewish history and I specialize in this. And then the next person's like, oh, I do contemporary American Jewish history or like 20th century. And like what they say next is not, oh, wow, that's a blind spot of mine. I'd like you to teach me that so that I can teach my class. Like they might be curious, but they don't feel like I, a medieval Jewish historian, should know and be teaching 20th century Jewish history. Like that's not how it works because there's a sense of like, okay, different people specialize in different things. The idea that a rabbi is supposed to be the Magid also, that feels like almost kind of imperialist. It's like a rabbi is the thing that leads Jews. And so any form of role that is doing anything to a room full of Jews, a rabbi feels like, and by the way, I am one, right? Like we feel like somehow we are supposed to be an expert at that thing. And I don't like that very much because I don't think it's practically helpful. I don't think anybody can actually be a specialist, a real talented person across, you know, Magiding and service leading and life cycle event officiating and Torah study teaching and sermon writing. Like you can't be amazing at all of those things. And yet somehow we have this presumption that you're supposed to be. And so I'm curious, like when you mentioned that story where it's like, oh, interesting reaction that you want me to teach you about this. Like, tell me more about that.
Well, so the few times it's come up, my first thought, and this is said with like no shade, zero shade is here, is like, okay, well, what are you doing in those 4 to 5 years then? What's the rest of it, right? Because I think for me, I think of like storytelling as such a fundamental part of just human existence that it seems like there would be, I don't know, a unit, a class, a workshop, a something that introduces those ideas. When people tell me this, I think what they're sort of getting down to is delivering a sermon, delivering a drash in a way that people want to hear it and will take something away from it. Not just sort of, oh, this is the thing that I wrote and I'm going to read it, but really delivering in a way that hits people in their heart and their mind and their body and their soul, that they go away with some nugget of wisdom, some nugget of realization that they didn't have before. Which I think kind of gets into, I think something you said towards the beginning, Lex, this idea of performing is not a bad thing. And I'm not saying that every rabbi or every cantor should do a little jig when they are sort of giving a drash. That's not what I'm saying, but there has to be a connection between the person who's in front of the community, who's in front of the congregation, whatever that might look like, and to the words that they are speaking or saying. In my program, one of the things that Rabbi Zaslow didn't want us to do was actually like just read a drash. He didn't want us to just read them, like, you know, internalize it, maybe make some notes, but don't read it. There's this relationship between reading something and then delivering the words of Torah that you've written. And I think that's really what folks are asking me to teach them how to do when this comes up.
I'm not sure that they shouldn't do a little jig. I mean, I think it would probably be a lot more effective if they did. I was once at a mega church that I was researching, and at the sermon, whatever you want to call it, they literally brought out, it was about like Jesus is knocking at your door, and they literally brought out a door. Like they wheeled out a piece of stage scenery, you know, that was a door that came out onto the stage, and the preacher was literally knocking on that door. And I remember this 15 years later, you know, it was so effective. And so I think that the question of like, what are they teaching is a really interesting one. I thought you were going to go somewhere else when you said, you know, these rabbis are all coming to you and saying, you know, teach me what you do. It's like, I'm not, a good magician doesn't reveal his tricks. Like, you should invite me to magid at your synagogue. But I'm not teaching you my secrets. But that actually leads me to a question about what you are going to be teaching in yeshiva class. Because on the one hand, we don't want anybody, for all kinds of reasons, to be under any illusions that they're going to come out of a three-session class and they're going to be a magid, because it's a much more serious endeavor than that, and nobody should imagine that. But I would imagine that there are certain techniques, there are certain things that make a story told well. And I'm curious if that's some of what your class is going to be about, or what is your imagination that you would like to be able to get out there for regular Jews who can encounter this tradition for the first time?
Absolutely. And I'm actually going to have to sort of remember that the next time sort of a clergy person asks me this question, be like, oh, like, let me come to your community. We'll work it out.
Yeah, I'll say, or later, pay me.
Exactly. I'll come, pay me. Thank you. So for the class, one of the big thing that I'm experimenting with is sort of this question that I mentioned a little bit earlier about, you know, what is my role in the Megiddic education landscape? And I'm actually really excited about this class because I think it's sort of my first opportunity to sort of start to not formalize it, but to try a couple of different formats. And so my sort of thesis idea for this class is finding ourselves in these stories that we either hear or that we're telling. And I'm using that as kind of my anchor point because I sort of feel like if we can't see ourselves in them, if we can't find ourselves, then what are we doing telling them? You know, what is the point if I can't access this in a way that feels personal? So we'll be using some techniques, some exercises, some things that I'm still sort of working out to do that. You know, so I'm planning to tell a few stories, of course, during the course itself. Like, okay, here's the story that I'm telling you. Now compare with the story that I just told you with maybe this text, for example. And maybe that text is like two paragraphs long, but I've just told you an 8-minute story that somehow also involves the queer sports league that I play with in Philadelphia, right? And sort of starting to marry these concepts together of putting ourselves into these stories, because there's this idea that in theater, we talk about this a lot, that representation matters, that visibility matters. And what I'm hoping to accomplish by focusing on that is to also allow folks who are in this class or maybe even not in this class, well, in this class, I should say specifically, to start to think about maybe the stories that they know, the stories that they have been told their whole lives, or maybe the stories they tell, whether that's formal or informal with friends, what have you, and how are they in those stories, and how do they allow others to see themselves in them as well? Some of like how I have come to start to see myself in stories has been, you know, like maybe I'll be reading a story. And this is something that I learned from Deborah Zaslow. Just like, okay, you know, like read the story, like get a sense of it, and then go into this like meditative space where it's like, okay, in this story, there are like these three characters. What do they look like? What are they doing? How are they dressed even? What is the location of this story? What does that location look like to you? How does it feel? What colors are in it? We'll definitely be doing some of that kind of imagining together. But on the other side of that, I have a colleague who has described my storytelling style as irreverent, but not disrespectful. The flip side of sort of, you know, how do we start to see ourselves in these stories, both from like the perspective of using sort of exercises and discussion questions and things like that, will also help be informed by how I'm telling a story. Like, okay, like perhaps this story from the Talmud does not use any of these words that I, the Magid Marcus Holly, have used, but that is a way that I have personalized it to be mine. And so that is also something I'm sort of toying with for the class. It's like, okay, what does it look like to maybe to have folks say, okay, this is a story that I know, or this is a story that we just heard. How would I tell this?
I'm thinking back to what you were saying about being in the opera world and thinking about La Boheme as being kind of, maybe we've done it enough times. And I was thinking about that in relationship to the show Rent, which is based on La Boheme, but it brought the basic story of La Boheme into another world of people in two ways. One is that it made it available to people who don't listen to opera or who don't enjoy opera. And two is that it made a connection between the basic storyline. I mean, the basic storyline of La Boheme is about tuberculosis, but it translated it to be about AIDS, and it made it now relevant to people at the time that Rent came out, where the AIDS crisis was in full force. And you could imagine that if in the opera world, they're just saying, hey, this story is tired, it's old, we've done it so many times. And yet in another world, it was fresh and new and meaningful and could be translated to contemporary issues. And there's something about the story of La Boheme that lasted so long in the world of opera because it's a really good story. And so I guess I'm wondering about how we think about the role of storytellers today. Is the goal really to tell a new story, or is the goal somehow to understand in the deepest possible way what stories work? You know, and I guess I'm wondering in some way whether are there new stories in the world? Are there new stories that work really, really well? I mean, I can imagine that there are new stories that don't work, you know, but are there new stories that work, or really is what storytelling about is kind of, even if you're not conscious of it, is somehow understanding that there's a human need for certain stories, and we just keep learning to tell that story in a new way, in a more relevant context. And if that's the case, then again, I'm kind of fascinated by, I'd love to know more about your process of going through that story of Jacob and finding his queerness, because maybe in some way what you're really doing there too is a version of translating La Boheme into Rent. I'm just curious about that whole process of how you mine a story for its true deep storiness and then translate that to a more contemporary audience.
I think the whole answer to your question so far is just yes and. I also appreciate the Boheme to Rent to me and Jacob. Like I'm loving that whole idea. So thank you for that, Dan. It kind of depends. You know, what are we talking about when we say new? Does it mean like, okay, this whole thing like does not exist anywhere in the tradition or in the canon, and we need to create it? That's one definition of new. And then I also think, you know, what is around that maybe people just don't know about or people aren't paying attention to? And so an example of that is, you know, part of my program that I did is there was a series of books, like there were certain books that we had to read just to get to familiarize ourselves with the stories that were out there. And then we could sort of go rogue and do, I think, one or two of our own. And so I was at this little bookshop in Philly and I picked up this book. It's the collected stories of Moisir Sklar. And I was like, well, that is a heck of a name. Who is this guy? And he was this Brazilian Jewish writer who lived until I think the early 2000s. And I was like, okay, what's this guy writing? What's his deal? What's all of that about? And so I remember like I bought the book, took it home, and I was reading through. Some of his stories are like wild and kind of bizarre and like maybe border on like sci-fi, fantasy, futuristic. Some of them are sort of easy to get into, sort of easy to sort of find sort of the path through the story that maybe like finding what the story itself is trying to teach. And so one of the stories that I learned of his is actually about the angel of death and how this man who owns a business bamboozled the angel of death, right? And so telling that as maybe not as a story that's totally new, but from a perspective of someone else in the broader canon that maybe we're not, that maybe people don't know about or don't get to hear as often. So I think it's twofold. I think there's new things that are being created, and there are things that are sort of being brought to the surface as well. And when it comes to my process, when I'm sort of trying to internalize a story, it really depends. If it's something like Torah or Talmud, I will sort of see which sort of words are jumping out at me or which kind of ideas seem really prescient. So like with the Jacob example, like Ishtam, I like latched onto that. I was like, okay, there's something here. I don't know what it is yet, but this is jumping out at me. So I will start with that and sort of see where that leads. And I find that my own process is such that I have to be sort of focused on it for a while, and then I have to put it down. Maybe that means sort of going about the rest of my day, going on a walk or whatever. And when I'm not actively thinking about it, then there is some sort of background processing that happens. And it's like, oh, here are a couple other avenues to explore. Because sometimes you'll read something and it's like, okay, like this is nice. Do I care? Or this is nice. Do I want to take the time to internalize this story and find the message in it for a particular moment? And the answer is sometimes no. It's really about leaving space to discover what might be there.
So I would really like to talk about the title of your course for a few reasons. First off, you've used the phrase yes and a couple times, which of course, you know, a classic phrase of like improv. But the title of your course is Whose Canon Is It Anyway? Which is another improv allusion because of the show Whose Line Is It Anyway? Which was an improv show. Is it still on? I don't even know. But it was or is a show that, you know, featured improv comedy. And part two, you know, the word canon is right there. And you've used it a couple times in this conversation. And I think that in the realm of storytelling, the word canon is really important. And I think it's important in one potentially like liberating, exciting way and one potentially restricting or conservative way. I'll start with the less exciting, restrictive way. The idea that there is a canon of stories, like that, once again, that gets at what I was asking before about how like, oh, there are these stories that exist. And I'm really persuaded by what Dan said about how like, maybe we say that's true. And it's not that that restricts us necessarily. It's just that we must work from a certain set of stories and remap them, rethink them, remix them. But still, there's a potential that it could be restricting if somebody thinks that the operation of Mog Eating is like, oh, here's the set of books that one reads, and they don't get that creative exercise you had of you get to go rogue. So that's the restricting side. The liberating side is normally when people say canon, when people talk about the Jewish canon, they mean Bible and to some extent Talmud and, you know, later codes like Jewish legal texts that have been used to dictate rules and regulations for Jewish communities. And the second that we're using canon to include storytelling and Jewish story, that's actually an expansive, liberating move beyond that definition of canon. We've sort of done it slyly or like stealthily, but like by virtue of the name of your class, you have asserted that Jewish stories, not just the texts, quote unquote, but storytelling, Jewish stories are canonical. And so I'm curious to hear more from you in terms of how you think about that word canon and how it relates to, I mean, whether it's your course or just your general Mog Eating in the world.
Yeah, canon is such an interesting word because I agree, Lex, I definitely hear it or internalize it in sort of those two ways. When I think about sort of like theater and opera and things like that, it's like, okay, here's like the canon, here's the operatic canon. And from that canon, here are like the 20 to 25 things that we do all the time, forever and ever, amen. But that it's still expanding, like that the canon is still this ongoing project, whether or not sort of the gatekeepers, the people in charge, the whomevers, pick up those other pieces that are being added to the canon. Like when I started putting together, you know, which stories do I want to use in the class, there are stories from kind of all over the place. There are stories from Talmud. There are stories from Torah. There are stories that are folk stories. I'm thinking about working in an African traditional story or two to see, you know, where's the wisdom we can uncover from that? And in doing that, in engaging in that process of sort of putting these stories together, I'm sort of landing on this idea that canon is both a universal idea and also one that's deeply personal, that's deeply specific to the person who is talking about it, thinking about it, absorbing sort of some kind of material from it as well. There's sort of the personal canon of, you know, these are the ideas that I find particularly meaningful. These are the ideas that I want more of. And when I think about that in terms of sort of text, this actually just came to me. Like, I'm thinking about just the sheer number of books that I have on my bookshelf of stories. And one that just popped into my mind just now is, you know, I have Noam Siena's A Rainbow Thread, right? Mm-hmm. That whole queer collection of sort of Jewish stories and fragments. And that, for me, as a queer person, is an active piece of my canon, these kinds of queer stories. And so perhaps, you know, the gatekeepers, the powers that be, the people who have a vested interest in a specific subset of the canon, maybe that's not theirs, fine, but it's still part of it, and it's mine.
I want to be clear that, you know, I wasn't suggesting that the canon as we imagine it to be, whichever set of, you know, Jewish books we might talk about, that has all the stories in them. There are a lot of stories that were excluded from the canon for all kinds of reasons, largely because the people whose stories those are weren't part of the people making the canon. So that obviously we need an expanded canon. But part of the question for me is like, and I'm curious how you think about this. I think a lot of Jews, including and maybe especially the authority figures, imagine that Judaism, the source of Judaism is our texts, that Judaism flows out of our texts. And I actually have come to think that that's profoundly wrong, that the texts are actually just the writing down of elements of the pre-existing tradition, which was an oral tradition, a storytelling tradition. And I'm not just talking about the Talmud that we call the Oral Torah. I mean, talking about the written Torah. Before it was written, it was oral. And a lot of the oral elements probably were not written down, in part because they weren't the ones that people really liked the most. So, I mean, part of me feels like when they wrote down the canon, they wrote down the greatest hits, like the ones that people really liked the most. But the other piece of writing down the canon is that there might have been some stories that the people really liked, but the people in charge didn't like them so much because they didn't accord with their view of things. So either they would just not write down those stories, but sometimes, for example, I think the Golden Calf is potentially a good example of this. Sometimes they wrote it down, but in a way that made the Golden Calf makers look bad, where the original Golden Calf, which was the symbol of the Northern Kingdom, was actually something that the people really liked.
So I'm actually really glad that you sort of frame up the way you did, because something that I find that I do spend a lot of time reminding myself is, you know, if I'm reading something, whether it's Torah, Talmud, folktale, what have you, but this is what was written down. This is not perhaps the full story. It's the part that we have. And perhaps it's the part that we have because the person who wrote it down had an agenda. And kind of acknowledging that that is okay. That person's agenda doesn't have to be my agenda. In fact, it generally isn't. So I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I think it's something that I think is healthy for whether you're a storyteller or not to examine these things as you're reading them and honestly as you're hearing them. It's like, okay, this person is telling me this story in a particular way, or I'm reading this and the person who's transmitting this to me is trying to accomplish something. And I also think it's sort of important from the perspective of a listener. You, as a transmitter of a story, you might have a bullseye. There's a target. There is something that you want people who hear or read the story to walk away with. But you have no control over it once it's out of your mouth. You can't control how they're going to internalize it. And then that person who received that story, maybe they go and tell your story to someone else, the way they remember it or what they're hearing about it. And so that chain of transmission continues, whether or not sort of the original intent or purpose of that story when it was first told is actually maintained, which I think is one of the really interesting things about storytelling as a medium. So we change things all the time. And sometimes it's changing something because, well, we want to experiment with something else. Sometimes it's adding details that need to be there in order to transmit an idea to an audience. And sometimes that change is, in fact, mashing two different stories together. For example, there is a story in the Midrash, which I will define, as I heard a million years ago at a Shabbat service, as sort of rabbinic fan fiction. But there is this story that talks about why the second letter of the alphabet, Bet, is actually what starts the Torah as opposed to the Aleph. And it's this whole story that I've actually just been referring to as the Aleph's revenge, because the upshot is that the Aleph is actually pretty pissed about this and is like yelling at God for generations upon generations of like, why did you not choose me? And so when I learned that story, it's like, okay, I want to actually like flesh this out and add, you know, some stuff to it to have like a whole scene. I was reading a story that is like a take on that one, which included a kind of, I sort of threw in sort of what I'm calling like an alphabet or an alphabet kind of pageant, where each of the letters goes before God and is like, this is why you should choose me. And so sometimes it's that, it's putting things together. Sometimes it's taking things out. Sometimes it's tweaking minor details. There's a story, I don't tell it, but I've heard it told, about, that's often told as a boy with a flute, and it's Yom Kippur, and he sort of sneaks his flute into the synagogue, and his parents are mortified because he just wants to play his flute. The upshot of the story is that the rabbi is like, oh, like these are your prayers are through your flute. This is not, you know, a disruption. But I heard that story told once where instead of a little boy, it was a little girl. And instead of, you know, playing, instead of playing a flute, I think it was, you know, she wanted to be outside and pick the flowers because that's where her prayers were. And sort of thinking about just those little details and kind of the worlds that they open up for people, I think are really important when it comes to, you know, how we conceive of canon. At the same time, I think there's a line, right? It's not a hard line. I think it's a really, really fine line where it's like, okay, am I shifting this too much? Am I shifting this not enough? So it really depends on the story itself, but I think changing it for the sake of, I would say, clarity and sort of in the various kinds of clarity that we all need, I think is something that's really kind of fundamental to this work.
Are there any stories that you have found that either are older stories that you discovered or stories that you created that people who don't participate in typical mainstream Jewish life, you know, that they especially respond to, that get excited about?
There's one in particular that I'm thinking of, and it was actually the first story that I learned and have told. I usually tell it around Shavuot, and it's sort of, there's this episode in the Talmud, Moses having to convince the angels to give him the Torah, right? Like he scales the mountain and God's there and the angels are there. And it's a fascinating story because Moses is like, you know, yo, they could set me on fire. I don't want to talk to them about the Torah. And God's like, no, just go talk to them. It's fine. And it becomes this whole kind of almost a buddy comedy where it's like God and Moses are like, you know, teamworking the angels to get the Torah to come and bring down to sort of the rest of us. What's been sort of fun about telling that story in particular to folks sort of across, you know, various levels of observance and participation in Jewish life is that it adds, you know, some color to how we understand, you know, the revelation at Sinai. But at the same time, it also allows me to kind of really dig into some of those ideas as well. Like, okay, like Moses climbing a mountain, cool. Who's there when he gets there? Cool. We've got a couple of angels. If you know what those look like, that's terrifying. And then there's God. And here's Moses, who like doesn't want to be the leader of the church. He doesn't want to do any of this. And now he's faced with this insurmountable challenge with all of these divine beings as if this is just like a normal Tuesday. I think that story, as fantastical as it is, also allows a sense of personalization. I've been through tough stuff. Maybe I didn't have to climb a whole mountain and then talk to God and a bunch of angels to get the Torah, but I've also been through things that are difficult, things that are tough, things that I thought might end me, things that were dangerous to me, and have persevered. And there are just so many applications of like that story and sort of other stories like it that I really do love to tell, because in addition to being part of the, coming from the Talmud in particular, I think there's a certain weight that sort of is associated with that. And so knowing that this kind of story exists in that part of our tradition allows people across lines of practice, lines of participation to get something out of. And maybe what they're getting out of is something deeply, deeply spiritual on how they reveal Torah in the world, maybe. Or maybe it's that, you know, Moses has been through some stuff. I have been through some stuff, and it's okay. There's enough going on that there are lots of, I think, really powerful meanings that people can derive from it.
So just to close, I wanted to return really briefly to something you said quickly about how there might just be a need for roles that aren't rabbi and cantor. And Magid, I think you said enter Magid. Magid is one such role. I want to give a shout out. We've had a couple episodes in the past where we spoke with folks from Kohenet about how Kohenet is another role that is seeking to do a similar thing. You know, find something with some real Jewish precedent. Kohenet is not necessarily a new idea, but imbue it with a contemporary context and with contemporary ideas. Why do we need other roles? That's my closing question. Like, what do we gain by having a diversity of Jewish leadership roles around that are not just rabbi and cantor? And what is it about our world generally, forgetting just Jews, but also about Jewish life in particular, that is better and would be better if Magiding became recognized as one of those roles, more concretely than it already is?
I think one of the things that having more roles enables us to do, it allows people to actually sort of, for lack of a better term, specialize. This is what I do, and this is the particular sort of niche that I fill. Related to that, although sort of a different idea, is that I think it allows people to see, oh, there are more possibilities than being a rabbi or a cantor. I can be a Magid or a Kohenet, and I'm sure that there are other things that I'm not thinking of that kind of fit into this list. But I think it opens up how people potentially see themselves and what roles that they might fill. And I want to clarify that slightly. Like, I'm not saying that we should have Magids and whatnot around so that more people can become them. I'm also not saying that. When you expand what's possible in a tradition, you give people more ways to connect to it. Even if they don't want to go down a Magidic path or Kohenet path or anything like that, it allows them to see their tradition, to understand their tradition, to embody their tradition in a different way. And perhaps that different way is the way that they've been missing or the way that they need, or that fills in a gap for them that maybe your more sort of standard roles of clergy or what have you weren't doing for them.
Thank you so much, Marcus Holly, for joining us. We are so excited to have you teaching your mini course in the Un Yeshiva, and this has been a just fantastic conversation.
Thank you.
And thank you so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. A couple little notes before we fully close out. First off, sign up for Marcus Holly's awesome class, or for one of our other classes, or do an and/or. Sign up for multiple of our Un Yeshiva mini courses. You can check all of them out, including Marcus Holly's class called Whose Canon Is It Anyway? At judaismunbound.com/classes. And we hope that you'll do that. Another note, we are one of many dozen co-sponsors of the Jewish Rally for Abortion Justice, which is taking place in Washington, D.C. on May 17th. As we release this episode on May 13th, that's just a few days away. We really encourage people who are able to get to Washington, D.C. to go. This is one of the biggest rallies from a Jewish lens for anything in a very, very long time. And it's an important cause. So we hope that you will make a point to be there. You can find out more and register to attend at jewishrally.org. So now, just to let you know the different ways that you can be in touch with us. First, there are our Facebook and Twitter and Instagram pages. All of those are at Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And third, you can always email us at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. Another request we would make and would deeply appreciate is if you are able to support us financially, which you can do on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift via judaismunbound.com/donate. The very last thing that we'd say is that support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.